I'd like now to welcome Peter Simonson. He is Executive Director of the ACLU of New Mexico. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me.
So we are following up on this ongoing set of questions about what is going on in the detention center, specifically in Artesia, New Mexico, and the larger question of refugees who are coming over from Central America. You have been following this very closely, and we'll get into what the ACLU is doing. But there are many people who are fleeing an extremely dangerous set of circumstances. What are they fleeing from?
Boy, there are a diverse set of circumstances based on the folks that we have interviewed. One of the plaintiffs in the litigation that we filed last week was a woman from Honduras who fled to this country with her 2-3-year-old sons, twins, whose husband had been murdered by a gang in Honduras, and then had turned their threats upon her. Other people were fleeing threats of sexual violence or being forced into prostitution, threats of kidnapping. But in many instances, it was people have had family members murdered and then experienced threats against their own lives or the lives of their children. And that oftentimes is a scenario that prompts people to come here.
We've talked on this program about some of the background, including Reagan's wars in the 1980s and so on. Why is the crisis so acute right now? Did something happen that precipitated so many people coming?
I don't know that I can speak to the specific flare-up of immigration to the U.S. right now. Certainly, it's tied into, as you point out, I guess, a history of immigration and deportation that's gone on for the last 20, 30, 40 years, and the exportation of gang cultures and narco trafficking from our country to these smaller communities, to the point where now we have a situation where neither local governments and even national governments are capable of dealing with the chaos and the violence that is being created by these groups.
Now, how do the folks who are, for example, in Artesia, how do they get to New Mexico? We've heard some grueling accounts of that train, that freight train called the Beast, where so many people are injured. What is your experience of how people actually arrive here?
Well, it's the people that we spoke to, most of them had come from other parts of the country, mostly Arizona, I believe, and had been held in short-term custody for a while before being transferred to the detention center. Yeah, I mean, the folks that I can think of, those were the stories that we'd heard.
So what is the law regarding refugees?
Well, for Central American refugees, it differs, of course, for Mexican children. But where these families are concerned, the law is that they are able to cite a fear of returning to their country. And if they do that, then they are required to go before an asylum officer who then hears their story, hears their case, and makes a determination about whether or not they should go before an immigration judge and ultimately have a formal decision rendered on their ability to get political asylum in this country. There are, I believe, five different kinds of credible fear under federal law that an individual can qualify for. There's, if you can cite a fear of political persecution based on your political beliefs, based on religious beliefs, based on a social group that you belong to, a religious group that you belong to. It's my understanding that when an asylum officer is actually interviewing people, that they are trying to identify whether or not someone complies with the criteria in those various groups.
Does fear of being killed by gangs qualify?
Well, it's our contention that it certainly does. I think just in principle, I think any common sense individual would have to agree that whether the violence is being instituted by a political entity like a national government or by a band of gang members, violence is violence, and if a person's life is legitimately threatened, that those should constitute the grounds for receiving asylum in our country. It's been our sense that the category concerning social groups and possibly even political groups actually applies in those circumstances.
You said a moment ago that the laws around refugees for Central America, are there different refugee laws depending on what country you come from?
Yeah, I don't know all of the details, but under the Trafficking Victims Protection Act, TVPRA, I didn't quite get that right, but the TVPRA, a federal law that governs the kinds of asylum protections that children receive in these kinds of circumstances, are rather more expansive for Central American children than they are for Mexican children. A few years ago, Congress rolled back some of the protections for Mexican children that make it easier to deport them with a more expedited, yet even more expedited process for Mexican children than what we have for Central American children. And, of course, the debate in Congress recently has been whether or not to amend the TVPRA to apply the same standards to Central American children that apply to Mexican children. The rationale for having a different set of standards where Central American children are concerned is that you're transporting them beyond national boundaries into a country that's not contiguous with the U.S.
Which seems to the how should we say, non-bureaucratic ear, kind of weird because, I mean, human trafficking is human trafficking.
Yeah, I mean, it's our feeling that no distinction should be drawn, and our organization is looking at the constitutionality of these relaxed due process standards for Mexican children as well. I mean, I think, you know, when it really comes down to it, whether families are coming from Mexico or whether they're coming from Honduras, Guatemala, or El Salvador, in many instances, these families are genuinely fleeing just unimaginable scenarios of violence, horrors that I think any of us would find hard to conceive experiencing in our own country. And we as a country should not be throwing these families right back into harm's way. All we would like to see is that these families be given a fair hearing, and they're not receiving that right now. And the consequences of rushing these vulnerable mothers and children through legal proceedings like this are life and death. The stakes are life and death. We've heard this whole crisis described as a humanitarian crisis, and the administration has used that rhetoric, and you've heard it repeated in the press and newspapers. Typically, when people have used that term, it's been to describe sort of the demand on our government resources to respond to the sudden influx of families from Central America. But I think there's yet another kind of humanitarian crisis that's happening in our country, and it's our own capacity to be humanitarian. We are following a government that is turning a blind eye to unimaginable violence that families are facing. I think it runs counter to basic American values that we don't respond with compassion and with empathy to women and children who are seeking refuge in this country to escape the possibility that they or their children will either be murdered or conscripted into prostitution or being sexually exploited or being kidnapped. We have an obligation to, as a country, to rise to this challenge, I believe, and provide a safe refuge for families that are fleeing these kinds of circumstances.
What do we know, what do you know, about people who have been fast-track deported back to, say, Honduras or El Salvador?
Well, I think our information is pretty incomplete at this point. There was a report in the LA Times just the week before last that a morgue director in a town, a city, San Pedro Sula in Honduras, had reported that since February, between 5 and 10 children had been who'd been previously deported had actually been murdered. So, you know, that's from one simple city in Honduras. One can imagine that that number is multiplied greatly when you begin to take both El Salvador and Guatemala into consideration. So the simple fact is that whether we like it or not, whether we're willing to admit it or not, our government is in fact deporting people, in some instances, maybe in many instances, to their deaths. And frankly, we as taxpayers are made complicit in those actions. And it's one of the reasons, it's one of the many reasons our organization and three other national organizations stepped forward and decided to file litigation to do whatever we could to try and bring a stop to this process.
We're talking to Peter Simonson, Executive Director of the ACLU of New Mexico. So basically, it's a situation where children have taken, and sometimes their mothers, these long, very, very expensive, terrifying and dangerous journeys, gotten to the United States, been fast-track deported. They were fleeing from a fear of death. They were deported and died. This is what we're looking at. At least that's part of the story. Now, why fast-track deportations given the circumstances from which these people are fleeing?
Yeah, I mean, I can only speculate that it just feeds the, you know, it's driven by the ongoing anti-immigrant rhetoric and the administration's desire to continue to sort of kowtow to that national rhetoric that characterizes all immigrants as illegal, as aliens, as criminals in our country, without acknowledging the human factors that surround the process of immigration and the fact that we might want to believe that there are individual, self-serving, opportunistic immigrants coming across to steal our jobs and our benefits and such. But the simple fact is that the reality is that the great majority of immigrants that come to this country immigrate in a family structure. They bring their children. They come to this country as a way to improve the opportunities that their children have. And in this instance, of course, they're simply trying to guarantee that their children can continue to live and survive. You know, you just have to look at how the administration has crafted these policies and the rhetoric that they've used to justify these policies, to see that it's really an attempt to continue to sort of respond to this anti-immigrant sentiment that I suspect that at the end of the day they assume continues to score political points with the majority of the American electorate.
And I think it's important just to underscore that the people fleeing for their lives are different from the people fleeing because they want to get jobs or get better jobs. I mean, one is a poverty circumstance, one is a life and death circumstance, and maybe there's some gray area between them, but the Central American situation right now seems not to be, it's a refugee crisis, not an immigration crisis.
Exactly. I mean, as I've said, folks are fleeing circumstances that are simply intolerable. And, you know, to go into the Artesia facility, as I did and as the director of our border office, the Regional Center for Border Rights, did a couple weeks ago, and interview these families is just for me and for Vicky, our director, was a tremendously emotional experience. You know, to interview, to talk to women surrounded by their children who are faced with the prospect of being thrown back into a situation that, you know, where they may be looking at their imminent death or the threats to their children, you know, these interviews were typically very emotional, difficult to get through, difficult for me and other interviewers to experience, and not to just feel an overwhelming empathy for people who genuinely want to escape violence and are terrified at the prospect of being returned to those kinds of situations.
Tell us some of the specific stories you heard.
Well, I specifically spoke to a woman from Guatemala who had been the victim of sexual abuse in her family over many, many years, and had fled, had tried to get help from the local authorities, and when she did that, was told that they couldn't do anything to help her, and then the abuser threatened to kill her and her child if she tried to get help. And so she left the country. She, when I spoke to her, was, hysterical at the thought of being returned to that. I spoke to another woman whose brother-in-law from Honduras, whose brother-in-law had been murdered, and then her sister and she both had begun to receive death threats from this gang in Honduras. One of the clients in our litigation is a mother who fled El Salvador with her two children, again, because of threats that they'd received from a gang that controls the area where they live. The same gang was stalking her 12-year-old child every time he left the house, and they began to threaten kidnapping him. And then she was told that the police officers knew about the gangs, knew what they were doing, and yet they themselves were afraid to actually confront the gang members. Another mother who is a plaintiff in our litigation fled El Salvador with her 10-month-old son after a gang had threatened to kill her and her baby. The gang basically told her that if she didn't become an informant for them on the activities of another gang, that she had 48 hours to leave the country or be killed. So the stories just, the stories go on and on and on, and all you have to do is look in the eyes of these mothers and of the children and know that what you're being told is absolutely fact-based, that there is genuine fear, there is genuine terror at the prospect of returning to these countries, and as I say, we have created a detain and deport policy, in the words of our administration, that eliminates the prospect of actually getting legitimate asylum. That, I mean, the administration has talked about this as a detain and deport policy, not as a policy of detain, check for possibilities of asylum, and deport if folks don't meet those criteria. Now, it's been made clear by the Department of Homeland Security and by the president himself that asylum really isn't part of the deal.
Now, you have joined with other groups, you, the ACLU, to file a lawsuit on behalf of some of these people. What is the suit about? Tell us about it.
Well, it's there are many different civil rights issues that surround this whole dynamic. This particular, the conditions in the Artesia facility, whether or not people who appear to meet the at least preliminary standards for achieving asylum are allowed to bond out and can wait in the community before they actually receive a hearing with an immigration judge. But this particular lawsuit actually addresses the due process issues surrounding the asylum process, and some of the claims that we make in our complaint is that the administration is categorically prejudging asylum cases with this detain and deport policy, regardless of individual circumstances. That families are giving very restricted communication with the outside world. Keep in mind that Artesia is this the Artesia facility sits out in the middle of really nowhere, surrounded by over 200 miles of desert. The nearest major town is, the nearest major city is El Paso. When we were there, if women were able to make phone calls at all, they were cut off after 3 minutes when consulting with attorneys. They have limited access to telephones. So the prospect of trying to get legal help to help in these immigration hearings is very limited. Now, it's improved only because some national organizations and actually local New Mexico organizations have begun to visit the facility on a regular basis and interview people and try to provide these services. But particularly at the outset, those kinds of services were virtually unavailable. And you can only imagine what families might have been feeling facing an immigration judge with the life of your family literally hanging in the balance and trying to make a case to an immigration judge who's on the other end of a video line without having a lawyer by your side. So, you know, it's these kinds of due process questions that the lawsuit addresses. The fact that detainees were given virtually no notice of critically important interviews that are oftentimes used to determine the outcome of asylum requests. Folks have very little time to prepare for their interviews. They're rushed through the interviews. In some instances, officials would cut people off in the interview process or would be probed about very traumatic, asked very traumatic questions that would ask people to recount experiences of rape or, when their children were threatened, even while their children were listening.
In front of their children, they were asked to recount these things in front of their own children.
Mm-hmm, sometimes even in front of their children.
So basically, what you're saying is, we're not following even our own rules. We're not following our own laws about asylum seekers.
I mean, I think the government will make the argument that if you read the letter of the law, they can come up with a rationale for why they believe they are attending to the letter of the law. But the reality is that the process itself falls way outside what the law would require. And particularly if we are not acknowledging that what's at stake here is whether or not families have a credible fear of returning to their country. And the asylum process is designed to determine whether a family has a credible fear. There is no question but that the majority of these families do, in fact, have a credible fear and at least deserve a fair opportunity to make their case before an immigration judge to see if they can have asylum in this country.
If the lawsuit is successful, first of all, I'm wondering if it's a long process or something that will be decided quickly, but if it is successful, what happens next?
I'm not clear what the timeline might be on the case and how quickly it would move. But our hope is, of course, that if the lawsuit is successful, that we would force policy changes through injunctive relief in the way that this process is meted out, and that there would be requirements put in place, standards put in place that would guarantee that people have fair access to telephones to be able to communicate with attorneys, ample access to information about legal service providers, opportunities to prepare themselves for asylum interviews and for hearings before immigration judges. Those are all the sorts of things that we're hoping would be corrected by the lawsuit.
Is it a lawsuit in federal court? Would it affect the rules for the whole country?
Yes, it was filed in the D.C. district. The rules, I believe the rules would actually pertain to the Artesia facility in particular, but by... In fact, I think the result would be to have changes that would be nationwide.
I think many of us are looking on in horror. What is our role? What can ordinary citizens do, if anything?
I think it's important for for our congressional delegates to know that people in New Mexico are concerned about this. What I have heard is, not from our congressional delegation specifically, but I fear that they do not hear enough uproar from the American public, that we just won't stand for this kind of inhumane and callous treatment towards families that are seeking our help. And I think that we as individuals can serve this community by making that fact known to our congressional delegates, because there may be changes that could be implemented at that level as well.
I think there are so many people who would be willing to help in numerous ways to provide, food, shelter, and clothing. I think there are lawyers who, and they're probably already stepping up to provide help to the extent that they're welcome to, and people to provide trauma counseling and things like that. I mean, there's a big need there, and I think Americans, at least some of them, the ones who aren't working in this paradigm of prejudice, are the kind of Americans that you were talking about before, people who do have compassion, who are willing to step up.
And you sort of highlighted it that at least within the legal community, because they're really the only ones that have the opportunity to step up in this situation right now, particularly here in New Mexico, but even nationwide, people are stepping up. I know immigration attorneys around our state are trying to respond, are trying to help out, to provide representation in these asylum interviews and then in the hearings. As I said, ALA, the American Immigration Lawyers Association, has also organized a cadre of volunteers to go down into the facility and to provide as much legal help as possible. But the fact of the matter is that it shouldn't require this kind of effort from the nonprofit community to try and make sure that folks are getting the due process that they deserve. Our government should be looking out for these key concepts. These are basic principles in our Constitution, the concept of due process, and guaranteeing that people in our country are given those basic guarantees.
Peter Simonson is executive director of the ACLU of New Mexico. If people want more information, what should they do?
They can certainly go to our website, which is aclu-nm.org, as well as our national website, aclu.org. There will be updates there on a regular basis, and you can also find on our national site regular blogging about this issue, which will include updates about the status inside Artesia and the status of the lawsuit.
Peter Simonson, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Oh, thank you so much. Very much my pleasure.